their ranks longer. They must advance while their men's blood was up, or all fervor would dissipate and terror flood inevitably into the vacuum. Now the river worked against the enemy. His four ranks descended into the defile yet a quarter mile from the Spartans. Up they came, their already disordered dress and interval disintegrating further. They were again on the flat now, but with the river to their rear, the most perilous place it could be in the event of a rout. Leonidas stood patiently watching, flanked by the battle priests and Decton with his goats. The enemy was now a fifth of a mile off and accelerating the pace of his advance. The Spartans still hadn't moved. Decton handed over the first she-goat's leash. We could see him glancing apprehensively as the plain began to thunder from the pounding of the enemy's feet, and the air commenced to ring with their fear and rage-inspired cries. Leonidas performed the sphagia, crying aloud to Artemis, Huntress, and the Muses, then piercing with his own sword the throat of the sacrificial goat, whose haunches he pinned from behind with his knees, his left hand hauling the beast's jaw exposed as the blade thrust through its throat. No eye in the formation failed to see the blood gush and spill into Gaia, maternal earth, splattering as it fell Leonidas's bronze greaves and painting crimson his feet in their oxhide battle soles. The king turned, with the life-fled victim yet clamped between his knees, to face the Scyrtae, Spartiates, Perioikoi, and Tegeates, who still held patient and silent in their massed ranks. He extended his sword, dark and dripping the blood of holy sacrifice, first heavenward toward the gods, whose aid he now summoned, then around toward the fast-advancing enemy. "Zeus, Savior and Eros," his voice thundered, eclipsed but not unheard in that cacophonous din. "Lacedaemon!" The sarpinks sounded advance, trumpeters sustaining the eardrum-numbing note 10 paces after the men had stepped off, and now the piper's wail cut through, shrill notes of their auloi piercing the melee like the cry of 1,000 furies. Decton heaved the butchered goat and the live one over his shoulders and scampered like hell for the safety of the ranks. To the beat, the Spartans and their allies advanced, 8-footers at the upright, their honed and polished spear points flashing in the sun. Now the foe broke into an all-out charge. Leonidas, displaying neither haste nor urgency, fell into step in his place in the front rank as it advanced to envelop him, with the knights flowing impeccably into position upon his right and left. Now from the Lacedaemonian ranks rose the paean, the hymn to Castor ascending from 4,000 throats. On the climactic beat of the second stanza, heaven-shining brother, sky-born hero, the spears of the first three ranks snapped from the vertical into the attack. Words cannot convey the impact of awe and terror produced upon the foe, any foe, by this seemingly uncomplex maneuver called in Lacedaemon spiking it or palming the pine, so simple to perform on the parade ground and so formidable under conditions of life and death. To behold it executed with such precision and fearlessness, no man surging forward out of control nor hanging back in dread, none edging right into the shadow of his rank-mate's shield, but all holding solid and unbreakable, tight as the scales on a serpent's flank, the heart stopped in awe. The hair stood straight up upon the neck, and shivers coursed powerfully the length of the spine. As when some colossal beast, brought to bay by the hounds, wheels in his fury, bristling with rage and baring his fangs, and plants himself in the power and fearlessness of his strength, so did the bronze and crimson phalanx of the Lacedaemonians now snap as one into its mode of murder. The left wing of the enemy, 80 across, collapsed even before the shields of their promachoi, the front rankers, had come within 30 paces of the Spartans. A cry of dread rose from the throats of the foe, so primal it froze the blood, and then was swallowed in the tumult. the enemy left broke from within. This wing, whose advancing breadth had stood an instant earlier at 48 shields, abruptly became 30, then 20, then 10, as panic flared like a gale-driven fire from terror-stricken pockets within the massed formation. Those in the first three ranks who turned in flight now collided with their comrades advancing from the rear. Shield rim caught upon shield rim, spear shaft upon spear shaft. A massive tangle of flesh and bronze ensued as men bearing 70 pounds of shield and armor stumbled and fell, becoming obstacles and impediments to their own advancing comrades. You could see the brave men stride on in the advance, crying out in rage to their countrymen as these abandoned them. Those who still clung to courage pushed past those who had forsaken it, calling out in outrage and fury, trampling the four-rankers, or else, as valor deserted them too, jerked free and fled to save their own skins. At the height of the foe's confusion, the Spartan right fell upon them. Now even the bravest of the enemy broke. Why should a man, however valorous, stand and die while right and left, fore and rear, his fellows deserted him? Shields were flung, spears cast wildly to the turf. Half a thousand men wheeled on their heels and stampeded in terror. At that instant the center and right of the enemy's line crashed shields on into the central core of the Spartans. That sound, which all warriors know, but which to Alexandros's and my youthful ears had been heretofore unknown and unheard, now ascended from the clash and collision of the Othismos. Once, at home when I was a child, Bruxius and I had helped our neighbor Pyrion relocate three of his stacked wooden beehives. As we jockeyed the stack into place upon its new stand, someone's foot slipped. The stacked hives dropped. From within those stoppered confines, yet clutched in our hands, arose such an alarm, neither shriek nor cry, growl nor roar, but a thrum from the netherworld, a vibration of rage and murder that ascended not from brain or heart, but from the cells, the atoms of the massed polis within the hives. This self-same sound, multiplied 100,000-fold, now rose from the massed, compacted crush of men and armor roiling beneath us on the plain. Now I understood the poet's phrase, the mill of Ares, and apprehended in my flesh why the Spartans speak of war as work. I felt Alexandros's fingernails dig into the flesh of my arm. "Can you see my father? Do you see Deinikes?" Deinikes waded into the rout below us. We could see his cross-crested curry-brush at the right of the Heracles in the fore of the third platoon. As disordered as were the ranks of the enemy, so held the Spartans intact and cohesive. Their fore-rank did not charge wildly upon the foe, flailing like savages, nor did they advance with the stolid precision of the parade ground. Rather, they surged in unison like a line of warships on the ram. I had never appreciated how far beyond the interleaved bronze of the Promachoi's shields the murderous iron of their eight-footers could extend. These punched and struck overhand, driven by the full force of the right arm and shoulder, across the upper rim of the shield. Not just the spears of the front rankers, but those of the second and even the third, extending over their mates' shoulders to form a thrashing engine that advanced like a wall of murder. As wolves in a pack take down the fleeing deer, so did the Spartan right fall upon the defenders of Antirion, not in frenzied shrieking rage, lip-curled and fang-bared, but predator-like, cold-blooded, applying the steel with the wordless cohesion of the killing pack and the homicidal efficiency of the hunt. Deinikes was turning them. Wheeling his platoon to take the enemy in flank, they were in the smoke now. It became impossible to see. Dust rose in such quantities beneath the churning feet of the men, commingling with the screen of smoke from the tindered hulks, that the entire plain seemed afire, and from the choking cloud arose that sound, that terrible, indescribable sound. We could sense, rather than see, the Heracles Locos. Directly beneath us where the dust and smoke were thinner. They had routed the enemy left. Their front ranks now surged into the business of cutting down those luckless bastards who had fallen or been trampled, or whose panic-unstrung knees could not find strength to bear them swiftly enough from their own slaughter. On the center and right, along the whole line, the Spartans and Syracusans clashed, now shield to shield, helmet to helmet. Amid the maelstrom we could catch only glimpses, and those primarily of the rear rankers, 8 deep on the Lacedaemonian side, 12 and 16 deep on the Syracusan, as they thrust the 3-foot-wide bowls of their hoplon shields flush against the backs of the men in file before them, and heaved and ground and shoved with all their strength, the soles of their footgear churning up trenches in the plain and slinging yet more dust into the already choking air. No longer was it possible to distinguish individual men or even units. We could see only the tidal surge and back surge of the massed formations, and hear without ceasing that terrible, blood-stilling sound. As when a flood descends from the mountains, and the wall of water crashes down the dry courses, smashing into the stone-founded stakes and woven brush of the husbandman's dam, so did the Spartan line surge against the massed weight of the Syracusans. The dam's bulk, founded as firmly against the flood as fear and forethought may devise, seems itself to dig in and hold, to plant its force fiercely into the earth, and for long moments displays no sign of buckling. But then, as the anxious planter watches, before his eyes a surge begins to capsize one deep-sunken stake, another rush undermines a stacked stone revetment. Into each fraction of a breach the force and weight of the down-rushing wave thrusts itself irresistibly, hammering deeper, tearing and gouging, widening the gap and exploiting it with each successive ripping surge. Now the dam wall, which had cracked only a hand-breadth, splits to a foot and then a yard. The mass of the plunging flood builds upon itself as ton upon ton plummets in from the courses above, adding its weight to the irresistible ever-mounting tide. Along the banked margins of the watercourse, sheets of earth calve into the churning, boiling torrent. So now did the Syracusan center, pounded and hammered by the TG-8 heavy infantry, the king and the knights and the massed battalions of the Wild Olive, begin to peel and founder. The Scyrtae had routed the enemy right. From the left, the battalions of the Heracles rolled up the enemy flank. Each Syracusan wingman, forced to wheel to defend his unshielded side, meant another drawn off from the forward push against the frontally advancing Spartans. The sound of the keening struggle seemed to rise for a moment, then went dead silent as desperate men summoned every reserve of valor from their shrieking, exhausted limbs. An eternity passed in the time it takes to draw a dozen breaths, and then, with the same sickening sound made by the mountain dam as it gives way, unable to withstand the onrushing torrent, the Syracusan line cracked and broke. Now, in the dust and fire of the plain, the slaughter began. A shout, half of joy and half of awe, sprung from the throats of the crimson-tunicked Spartans. Back the Syracusan line fell, not in rout and riot, as their allies, the Antirrhionians, had done, but in still-disciplined squads and bunches, held yet by their officers, or whatever brave men had taken it upon themselves to act as officers, maintaining their shields to the fore, and closing ranks as they retreated. It was no use. The Spartan front rankers, men of the first 5 age classes, were the cream of the city in foot speed and strength, none save the officers over 25 years old. Many, like Polynices in the van among the knights, were sprinters of Olympic and near-Olympic stature, with garland after garland won in games before the gods. These now, loosed by Leonidas and driven on by their own lust for glory, pressed home the sentence of steel upon the fleeing Syracusans. When the trumpeters had blown, the sarpinx and its mind-numbing wails sounded the call to still the slaughter, even the rawest, untrained eye could read the field like a book. There, on the Spartan right, where the Heracles regiment had routed the Antirrhionians, one saw the turf unchurned and the field beyond littered with enemy shields and helmets, spears, and even breastplates, flung aside by the stampeding foe in his flight. Bodies lay scattered at intervals, face down, with the shameful gashes of death delivered upon their fleeing backs. On the right, where the stronger troops of the enemy had held longer against the Scyrtae, the carnage spread thicker and more dense. The turf chewed more fiercely. Along the battle wall which the foe had erected to anchor its flank, clumps of corpses could be seen, slain as they, trapped by their own wall, had struggled in vain to scale it. Then the eye found the center, where the slaughter had achieved its most savage concentration. Here the earth was rent and torn as if a thousand span of oxen had assaulted it all day with the might of their hooves and the steel of their plough's deep-churning blades. The chewed-up dirt, dark with piss and blood, extended in a line 300 meters across and 100 deep, where the feet of the contending formations had heaved and strained for purchase upon the earth. Bodies sprawled like a carpet upon the earth, mounded in places 2 and 3 deep. To the rear, across the plain where the Syracusans had fled, and along the riven walls of the watercourse, more corpses could be seen in scattered perimeters, manned by 2 and 3, 5 and 7, where these in their flight had closed ranks and made their stand, doomed as castles of sand against the tide. They fell with wounds of honor, facing their Spartan foe, cut down from the front. A wail arose from the hillsides, where the watching Antirrhionian skirmishers now looked down upon their comrades' vanquishment, while from the walls of the citadel itself wives and daughters keened in grief, as must have Hecuba and Andromache upon the battlements of Ilium. The Spartans were hauling bodies off the stacks of the dead, seeking friend or brother, wounded and clinging yet to life. As each groaning foeman was flung down, a Xiphos blade held him captive at the throat. "Hold!" Leonidas cried, motioning urgently to the trumpeters to resound the call to break off. "Attend them! Attend the enemy, too!" he shouted. And the officers relayed the order up and down the line. Alexandros and I, pounding pell-mell down the slope, had reached the plain now. We were on the field. I sprinted 2 strides behind as the boy ranged in mortal urgency among the blood and gore-splattered warriors, whose flesh seemed yet to burn with the furnace heat of fury, and whose breath appeared to our eyes to steam upon the air. "Father!" Alexandros cried in the exigency of dread, and then, ahead, he glimpsed the cross-crested officer's helmet, and then Olympias himself, upright and unwounded. The expression of shock upon the polemarch's face was almost comical when he beheld his son sprinting toward him out of the carnage. Man and boy embraced with wide-flung arms. Alexandros's fingers searched his father's corselet and breastplate, probing to confirm that all 4 limbs stood intact and no unseen punctures yet leaked dark blood. Dianeces emerged from the still-seething throng. Alexandros flew into his arms. "Are you all right? Did they wound you?" I raced up. Suicide stood there beside Dianeces, darning needle javelins in hand, his own face sprayed with the sling of enemy blood. A knot of staring men had clustered. I saw at their feet the torn and motionless form of Meriones, Olympias's squire. "What are you doing here?" Olympias demanded of his son, his tone turning to anger as he realized the peril the boy had put himself in. "How did you get here?" Around us, other faces reacted with equal wrath. Olympias swatted his son hard across the skull. Then the boy saw Meriones. With a cry of anguish, he dropped to his knees in the dirt beside the fallen squire. "We swam," I announced. A heavy fist cuffed me. Then another and another. "What is this to you, a lark? You come to sightsee?" The men were furious, as well they should have been. Alexandros, unhearing in his concern for Meriones, knelt over the man who lay upon his back, with a warrior crouched at each side, his helmetless head pillowed upon a hoplon shield, and his bushy white beard clotted with blood, snot, and sputum. Meriones, as a squire, had no cuirass to shield his breast. He had taken a Syracusan 8-footer right through the bone of the chest. A seeping wound pooled blood into the bowl of his sternum. His tunic bunched up, sodden with the dark, already clotting fluid. We could hear the hissing of air as his sucking lungs fought for breath and inhaled blood instead. "What was he doing in the line?" Alexandros's voice, cracking with grief, demanded of the gathered warriors. "He's not supposed to be there." The boy barked for water. "Bearer!" he shouted, and shouted again. He tore his own tunic, and doubling the linen, pressed it as a dressing against his fallen friend's air-sucking chest. "Why don't you bind him?" his youth's voice cried to the encircled, gravely watching men. "He's dying! Can't you see he's dying?" He bellowed again for water, but none came. The men knew why. And now, watching, it became clear to Alexandros, too, as it was already to Meriones.
"I've got 1 foot in the ferry, little old nephew," the ancient fighter's leaking airpipes managed to croak.
Life was ebbing fast from the warrior's eyes. He was, as I said, not a Spartan, but a Potidaean, an officer in his own country, taken captive long years past and never permitted to see his home again. With an effort that was pitiful to behold, Meriones summoned strength to lift one hand, black with blood, and placed it gently upon the boys. Their parts reversed, the dying man comforted the living youth.
"No happier death than this,"
his leaking lungs wheezed. "You will go home," Alexandros vowed. "By all the gods, I will carry your bones myself." Olympias knelt now too, taking his squire's hand in his own. "Name your wish, old friend. The Spartans will bear you there." The old man tried to speak, but the pipes of his throat would not obey him. He struggled weakly to elevate his head. Alexandros restrained him, then gently cradled the veteran's neck and lifted it. Meriones's eyes glanced to the front and the sides, where, amid the churned and liquid turf, the scarlet cloaks of other fallen warriors could be seen, each surrounded by a knot of comrades and brothers in arms. Then, with an effort which seemed to consume all his remaining substance, he spoke,
"Where these lie, plant me there. Here is my home. I ask none better."
Olympias swore it. Alexandros, kissing Meriones's forehead, seconded the vow. A dark peace seemed to settle upon the man's eyes. A moment passed, then Alexandros lifted his own clear, pure tenor in the hero's farewell. "That diamond which God breathed into me at birth, I, with glad heart, return now to him." In victory, Decton brought to Leonidas the rooster which would be sacrificed as thank-offering to Zeus and Nike. The boy himself was flushed with the triumph. His hands shook violently, wishing they had been permitted to hold a shield and spear and stand in the line of battle. For my own part, I could not stop staring about at the faces of the warriors I had known and watched in drill and training, but until now had never looked upon in the blood and horror of battle. Their stature, in my mind, already elevated beyond the men of any other city I had known, now rose close to that of heroes and demigods. I had witnessed the mere sight of them utterly rout the not unvaliant Antirrhionians, fighting before their own walls in defense of their homes and families, and overcome within minutes the crack troops of the Syracusans and their mercenaries trained and equipped by the tyrant Gelon's limitless gold. Nowhere in all the field had these Spartans faltered. Now, even in the hot blood aftermath, their discipline maintained them chaste and noble, above all vaunting and boasting. They did not strip the bodies of the slain, as the soldiers of any other city would eagerly and gloatingly do, nor did they erect trophies of vainglory and conceit from the arms of the vanquished. Their austere thank-offering was a single cock, worth less than an obol, not because they disrespected the gods, but because they held them in awe, and deemed it dishonorable to overexpress their mortal joy in this triumph that heaven had granted them. I watched Dionyces, reforming the ranks of his platoon, listing their losses, and summoning aid for the wounded, the traumatiae. The Spartans have a term for that state of mind which must at all costs be shunned in battle. They call it catalepsis, possession, meaning that derangement of the senses that comes when terror or anger usurps dominion of the mind. This, I realize now, watching Dionyces rally and tend to his men, was the role of the officer, to prevent those under his command at all stages of battle, before, during, and after, from becoming possessed. To fire their valor when it flagged, and rein in their fury when it threatened to take them out of hand. That was Dionyces' job. That was why he wore the transverse crested helmet of an officer. His was not, I could see now, the heroism of an Achilles. He was not a Superman who waded invulnerably into the slaughter, single-handedly slaying the foe by myriads. He was just a man doing a job. A job whose primary attribute was self-restraint and self-composure, not for his own sake, but for those whom he led by his example. A job whose objective could be boiled down to the single understatement, as he did at the hut gates on the morning he died, of performing the commonplace under uncommonplace conditions. The men were collecting their tickets now. These, to which I alluded earlier, are the wooden twig bracelets tied with twine, which each man makes for himself before battle to identify his corpse, if necessary, in the aftermath. A man writes or scratches his name twice, once on each end of the twig, then breaks it down the middle. The blood half he ties with string around his left wrist and wears with him into battle. The wine half stays behind in a basket maintained with the train in the rear. The halves are broken off jaggedly on purpose, so that even if the blood name were effaced or defiled in some other way, its twin would still fit in an unequivocally recognizable manner. When the battle is over, each man retrieves his ticket. Those remaining unclaimed in the basket number and identify the slain. When the men heard their names called and came forward to take their tickets, they could not stop their limbs from quaking. All up and down the line, one beheld warriors clustering in groups of twos and threes, as the terror they had managed to hold at bay throughout the battle now slipped its bonds and surged upon them, overwhelming their hearts. Clasping their comrades by the hand, they knelt, not from reverence alone, though that element was abundant, but because the strength had suddenly fled from their knees, which could no longer support them. Many wept, others shuddered violently. This was not regarded as effeminate, but termed in the Doric idiom hesma phobu, purging or fear-shedding. Leonidas strode among the men, letting all see that their king lived and moved unwounded. The men gulped greedily their ration of strong, heavy wine, and made no shame to drink water as well, and plenty of it. The wine went down fast and produced no effect whatever. Some of the men tried to dress their hair as if thereby to induce a return to normalcy, but their hands trembled so badly they could not do it. Others would chuckle knowingly at the sight, the veteran warriors who knew better than to try. It was impossible to make the limbs behave, and the frustrated groomers would chuckle back, a dark laughter from hell. When the tickets had all found their mates and been reclaimed by their owners, those pieces bereft within the basket identified the men who had been killed or were too badly wounded to come forward. These latter were claimed by brothers and friends, fathers and sons and lovers. Sometimes a man would take his own ticket, then another, and sometimes a third besides, weeping as he accepted them. Many returned to the basket just to look in. In this way they could perceive the numbers of the lost. This day it was 28. His Majesty may set this number in comparison alongside the thousands slain in greater battles and perhaps judge it insignificant. But it seemed like decimation now. There was a stir, and Leonidas emerged into view along the front of the assembled warriors. "Have you knelt?" He moved down the line, not declaiming like some proud monarch seeking satisfaction from the sound of his own voice, but speaking softly, like a comrade, touching each man's elbow, embracing some, placing an arm around others, speaking to each warrior man to man, peer to peer, with no kingly condescension. "Assemble," the word spread by murmur, without needing to be spoken. "Does every man have the halves of his ticket? Have your hands stopped shaking enough to fit them together?" He laughed, and the men laughed with him. They loved him. The victors formed up in no particular order, wounded and unwounded, plus squires and helots. They cleared a space for the king, those in front kneeling, to allow their comrades behind to see and hear, while Leonidas himself strode informally up and down the line, presenting himself so that his voice would carry and his face be seen by all. The battle priest, Olympius in this case, held the basket up before the king. Leonidas took out each unclaimed ticket and read the name. He offered no eulogy. No word was spoken but the name. Among the Spartans, this alone is considered the purest form of consecration. Alcamenes, Damon, Antalcides, Lysandros, on down the list. The bodies, already retrieved by their squires from the field, would be cleansed and oiled. Prayers would be offered and sacrifices made. Each of the fallen would be shrouded in his own cloak or that of a friend, and interred here upon the site, beside his mates, beneath a mound of honor. Shield, sword, spear, and armor alone would be borne home by his comrades, unless the omens declared it more honorable for his corpse to be restored and interred in Lacedaemon. Leonidas now held up his own bracelet, and slid the twin halves together into place. "Brothers and allies, I salute you. Gather, friends, and hear the words of my heart." He paused for a moment, sober and solemn. Then, when all stood silent, he spoke. "When a man seats before his eyes the bronze face of his helmet, and steps off from the line of departure, he divides himself, as he divides his ticket, in two parts. One part he leaves behind, that part which takes delight in his children, which lifts his voice in the chorus, which clasps his wife to him in the sweet darkness of their bed. That half of him, the best part, a man sets aside and leaves behind. He banishes from his heart all feelings of tenderness and mercy, all compassion and kindness, all thought or concept of the enemy as a man, a human being like himself. He marches into battle, bearing only the second portion of himself, the baser measure, that half which knows slaughter and butchery, and turns the blind eye to quarter. He could not fight at all if he did not do this." The men listened, silent and solemn. Leonidas at that time was 55 years old. He had fought in more than 20 battles since he was 20. Wounds as ancient as 30 stood forth, lurid upon his shoulders and calves, on his neck and across his steel-colored beard. "Then this man returns, alive, out of the slaughter. He hears his name called, and comes forward to take his ticket. He reclaims that part of himself, which he had earlier set aside. This is a holy moment, a sacramental moment, a moment in which a man feels the gods as close as his own breath. What unknowable mercy has spared us this day? What clemency of the divine has turned the enemy's spear one hand-breadth from our throat and driven it fatally into the breast of the beloved comrade at our side. Why are we still here above the earth, we who are no better, no braver, who reverenced heaven no more than these our brothers, whom the gods have dispatched to hell? When a man joins the two pieces of his ticket, and sees them weld in union together, he feels that part of him, the part that knows love and mercy and compassion, come flooding back over him. This is what unstrings his knees. What else can a man feel at that moment than the most grave and profound thanksgiving to the gods who, for reasons unknowable, have spared his life this day? Tomorrow their whim may alter. Next week, next year. But this day the sun still shines upon him. He feels its warmth upon his shoulders. He beholds about him the faces of his comrades whom he loves, and he rejoices in their deliverance and his own. Leonidas paused now, in the center of the space left open for him by the troops. I have ordered pursuit of the foe ceased. I have commanded an end to the slaughter of these whom today we called our enemies. Let them return to their homes. Let them embrace their wives and children. Let them, like us, weep tears of salvation and burn thank offerings to the gods. Let no one of us forget or misapprehend the reason we fought other Greeks here today. Not to conquer or enslave them, our brothers, but to make them allies against a greater enemy, by persuasion we hoped, by coercion in the event. But no matter, they are our allies now, and we will treat them as such from this moment. The Persian! Suddenly, Leonidas's voice rose, booming with such explosive emotion that those closest to him started from its sudden power. The Persian is why we fought here today. His presence loomed invisible over the battlefield. He is why these tickets lie bereft in this basket, why 28 of the noblest men of the city will never again behold the beauty of her hills, or dance again to her sweet music. I know many of you think I am half-cracked, I and Cleomenes, the king before me. Laughter from the men. I hear the whispers, and sometimes they're not such whispers. More laughter. Leonidas hears voices the rest of us don't. He takes chances with his life in an unkingly manner and prepares for war against an enemy he has never seen and who many say will never come. All this is true. The men laughed again. But hear this, and never forget it. The Persian will come. He will come in numbers, dwarfing those he sent 4 years ago, when the Athenians and Plataeans defeated him so gloriously on the plain of Marathon. He will come tenfold, 100-fold, mightier, and he will come soon. Leonidas paused again, the heat in his breast making his face flush and his eyes burn with fever and conviction. Listen to me, brothers. The Persian is not a king as Cleomenes was to us, or as I am to you now. He does not take his place with shield and spear amid the manslaughter, but looks on, safe, from a distance, atop a hill, upon a golden throne. Murmured jeers rose from the men's throats as Leonidas spoke this. His comrades are not peers and equals, free to speak their minds before him without fear, but slaves and chattel. Each man, even the noblest, is deemed not an equal before God, but the king's property, counted no more than a goat or a pig, and driven into battle not by love of nation or liberty, but by the lash of other slaves' whips. This king has tasted defeat at the Hellenes' hands, and it is bitter to his vanity. He comes now to revenge himself, but he comes not as a man worthy of respect, but as a spoiled and petulant child in its tantrum when a toy is snatched from it by a playmate. I spit on this king's crown. I wipe my ass on his throne, which is the seat of a slave, and which seeks nothing more noble than to make all other men slaves.
everything I have done as king, and everything Cleomenes has performed before me, every enemy courted, every confederation forged, every weak-kneed ally brought to heel, has been for this single event, the day when Darius, or one of his sons, returns to Hellas to pay us out." Leonidas lifted now the basket which held the tickets of the fallen. "That is why these, better men than ourselves, gave their lives here today, why they consecrated this earth with their hero's blood. This is the meaning of their sacrifice. They have dumped their guts not in this piss-puddle war we fought today, but in the first of many battles, in the greater war, which God in heaven and all of you in your hearts know is coming. These brothers are heroes of that war, which will be the gravest and most calamitous in history. On that day," and Leonidas gestured out over the gulf to Antirion below and Rion across the channel, "on that day, when the Persian brings his multitudes against us via this strait, he will find not clear passage and paid-for friends, but enemies united and implacable, Hellene allies who will sally to meet him from both shores. And if he chooses some other route, if his spies report what awaits him here, and he elects another passage, some other site of battle where land and sea play to our greater advantage, it will be because of what we did today, because of the sacrifice of these our brothers, whose bodies we inter now within a hero's grave. Therefore I have not waited for the Syracusans and the Antirionians, our enemies, this day, to send their heralds to us, as is customary, to entreat our permission to retrieve the bodies of their slain. I have dispatched our runners to them first, offering them truce without rancor, with generosity. Let our new allies reclaim unprofaned the armor of their fallen. Let them recover undefiled the bodies of their husbands and sons. Let those we spared this day stand beside us in line of battle on that day when we teach the Persian, once and for all, what valor free men can bring to bear against slaves, no matter how vast their numbers, or how fiercely they are driven on by their child king's whip."
Book 3. Rooster. Chapter 12. At this point in the recounting of the tale, an unfortunate incident occurred regarding the Greek Xeonides, a subordinate of the royal surgeon. During the ongoing attendance upon the captive's wounds, unwittingly informed the fellow of the fate of Leonidas, the Spartan king and commander at Thermopylae, after the battle at the Hot Gates, and what sacrilege to the Greeks' eyes his majesty's troops had performed upon the corpse after it was recovered from the heaps of the dead following the slaughter. The prisoner had hitherto been in ignorance of this. The man's outrage was immediate and extreme. He forthwith refused to speak any further on the subjects to hand, and in fact demanded of his immediate captors, Orontes and the officers of the immortals, that they put him also to death, and at once. The man Xeonides stood clearly in a state of extreme consternation over the beheading and crucifixion of the body of his king. All arguments, threats, and blandishments failed to dislodge him from this posture of grief. It was clear to the captain Orontes that, should his majesty be informed of the prisoner's defiance, however much he himself desired to hear the continuance of the man's tale, the captive Xeonides must, for his insolence to the royal person, be put to death. The captain, truth to tell, feared as well for his own head and those of his officers, should his majesty be frustrated by the Greek's intransigence in his desire to learn all he could about the Spartan enemy. Orontes had become, through various informal exchanges with the fellow Xeonides during the course of the interrogation, something of a confidant and even, if the word's meaning may be stretched to this point, a friend. He sought upon his own initiative to soften the captive's stance. To that end he attempted to make clear to the Greek the following: that the physical desecration performed upon the corpse of Leonidas,
was regretted keenly by His Majesty almost as soon as he had ordered it. The actual command had been issued amid the grief of the battle's aftermath, when His Majesty's blood was raging over the loss before his own eyes of thousands, by some counts as many as 20,000, of the Empire's finest warriors slain by the troops of Leonidas, whose defiance of God Ahura Mazda's will could only be perceived through Persian eyes as an outrage against heaven. In addition, two of His Majesty's own brothers, Hebrochemes and Hyperanthes, and more than 30 royal kinsmen had been sent down to the house of death by the Spartan foe and their allies. Moreover, the captain appended, the mutilation of Leonidas's corpse was, when viewed in the apposite light, a testament to the respect and awe in which the Spartan king was held by His Majesty, for against no other commander of the enemy had he ever ordered such extreme and, to Hellenic eyes, barbarous retribution. The Manzianese remained unmoved by these arguments and repeated his desire to be dispatched at once. He refused all food and water. It seemed that the telling of his tale would be broken off here and not resumed. It was at this point, fearing that the situation could not be kept from His Majesty much longer, that Orontes sought out Demaratus, the deposed king of Sparta, residing within the court as a guest exile and adviser, and urged his intercession. Demaratus, responding, betook himself in person to the royal surgeon's tent, and there spoke alone with the captive Zeonis for more than an hour. When he emerged, he informed the captain Orontes that the man had experienced a change of heart, and was now willing to continue the interrogation. The crisis had passed. "Tell me," the captain Orontes inquired, much relieved, "what argument and persuasion did you employ to effect this turnabout?" Demaratus replied, "that of all the Hellenes the Spartans were acknowledged the most pious, and held the gods most in awe." He declared it his own observation that in this regard among the Lacedaemonians, the lesser rankers and those in service, particularly the outlanders of the captive Zeonese's station, were almost without exception, in Demaratus's phrase, more Spartan than the Spartans. Demaratus had, he said, appealed to the fellow's respect for the gods, specifically Phoebus Apollo, for whom the man clearly evinced the most profound reverence. He suggested that the prisoner pray and sacrifice to determine as best he could the god's will. "For," he told the fellow, "surely the far striker had assisted your tale thus far. Why would he now order its discontinuance?" "Did the man Zeonese," Demaratus asked, "place himself above the immortal gods, presuming to know their unknowable will and stopper their words at his own whim?" Whatever answer the captive received from his gods, it apparently coincided with the counsel proposed to him by Demaratus. We picked up the tale again on the 14th day of the month of Tashritu. Polyneikes was awarded the prize of valor for Antirion. This was his second, achieved at the unheard-of age of 24 years. No other peer, save Deianikes, had been decorated twice, and that not until he was nearly 40. For his heroism, Polyneikes was appointed captain of the knights. It would be his honor to preside over the nomination of the 300 king's companions for the following year. This supremely coveted distinction, coupled with his sprinter's crown from Olympia, established Polyneikes as a beacon of fame whose brilliance shone forth far beyond the borders of Lacedaemon. He was perceived as a hero of all Hellas, a second Achilles, who stood now upon the threshold of unbounded and undying glory. To Polyneikes' credit, he refused to become puffed up over this. If any swelling of the head could be discerned, it manifested itself only in a more fiercely applied self-discipline, though this zeal for virtue, as events were to tell, could spill over into excess when applied to others less spectacularly gifted than himself. As for Deianikes, he had only been honored with inclusion in the company of knights once when he was 26, and had declined respectfully all subsequent nominations. He liked the obscurity of a platoon commander, he said. He felt more himself among the ranks. It was his conviction that he could contribute best by leading men directly, and that only to a certain number. He refused all attempts to promote him beyond the platoon level. "I can't count past 36," was his standard disclaimer. "Beyond that, I get dizzy." I will add, from my own observation, that Dianakis's gift and vocation, more so even than warrior and officer, was that of teacher. As all born teachers, he was primarily a student. He studied fear and its opposite. But to pursue such an excursus at this time would lead us astray from the narrative, to resume at Antirion. On the return passage to Lacedaemon, as punishment for accompanying Alexandros in following the army, I was removed from that youth's company and forced to march in the dust at the rear of the train with the sacrificial herd and my half-helot friend, Decton. This Decton had acquired at Antirion a new nickname, Rooster, from the event that, immediately following the battle, he had delivered the thank-offering cock to Leonidas, half-strangled in his own fists, so frenzied was he with excitement from the battle and his own frustrated desire to have participated in it. The name stuck. Decton was a rooster, bursting with barnyard belligerence and ready to scrap with anything his own size or three times bigger. This new tag was picked up by the whole army, who began to regard the boy as something of a good-luck talisman, a mascot of victory. This, of course, galled Decton's pride beyond even its accustomed bellicose state. In his eyes, the name embodied condescension, yet another reason to hate his masters and to despise his own position in their service. He declared me a blockhead for following the army. "You should have flown," he hissed sidelong as we trudged in the choking, fly-blown wake of the train. "You deserve every lash you get. Not for what they blame you for, but for not drowning that hymn-singer Alexandros when you had the chance, and churning your shanks straight to the Temple of Poseidon." He meant that sanctuary in Taineron to which runaways could flee and be granted asylum. My loyalty to the Spartans was rebuked with scorn and ridicule by Decton. I had been placed in this boy's power shortly after fate had brought me to Lacedaemon, 2 years earlier, when both he and I were 12. His family worked the estate of Olympias, Alexandros's father, who was related to Dianakis via his wife, Arete. Decton himself was a half-breed helot, illegitimately sired, so rumor had it, by a peer whose gravestone, "Idetikides, in war at Mantinea," lay along the Amyclean Way, opposite the line of Sisatia, the common messes. This half-Spartiate lineage did nothing to advance Decton's status. He was a helot, and that was it. If anything, the youths his age, and the peers even more so, regarded him with extra suspicion, reinforced by the fact of Decton's exceptional strength and athletic skill. At 14 he was built like a grown man and nearly as strong. He would have to be dealt with some day, and he knew it. I myself had been in Lacedaemon half a year then, a wild boy just down from the hills and consigned, since it was safer than risking ritual pollution by killing me, to the meanest of farm labor. I proved such an infuriating failure at this that my helot masters took their complaints directly to their lord Olympias. This gentleman took pity on me, perhaps for my free birth, perhaps because I had come into the city's possession not as a captive, but of my own uncoerced will. I was reassigned to the goat and kid detail. I would be a herd boy for the sacrificial animals, minding the train of beasts that serviced the morning and evening ceremonies and followed the army into the field for training exercises. The head boy was Decton. He hated me from the first. He saved his most blistering scorn for my tale, imprudently confessed, of receiving counsel directly from Apollo Farstriker. Decton thought this hilarious. Did I think, did I dream, did I imagine that an Olympian god, scion of Zeus Thunderer, protector of Sparta and Amycle, guardian of Delphi and Delos, and who knows how many other poleis, would piss away his valuable time swooping down to chat in the snow with a cityless Heliocacalminos like me? In Decton's eyes, I was the dumbest mountain-mad yokel he had ever seen. He appointed me the herd's chief asswiper. You think I'm going to get my back striped for handing the king a shit-caked goat? Get in there and make that pucker-hole spotless. Decton never missed an occasion to humiliate me. I'm educating you, bung-boy. These assholes are your academy. Today's lesson is the same as yesterday's. In what does the life of a slave consist? It is in being debased and degraded, and having no option but to endure it. Tell me, my free-born friend, how do you like it? I would make no response, but simply obey. He scorned me the more for that. You hate me, don't you? You'd like nothing better than to chop me down. What's stopping you? Give it a try. He stood before me one afternoon when we and the other boys were grazing the animals in the king's pasture. You've lain awake planning it, Decton taunted me. You know just how you'd do it with that Thessalian bow of yours, if your masters would let you near it, or with that dagger you keep hidden between the boards in the barn. But you won't kill me. No matter how much disgrace I heap on your head, no matter how miserably I degrade you. He picked up a rock and threw it at me, point-blank, striking me so hard in the chest it almost knocked me over. The other Helot boys clustered to watch. If it was fear that stopped you, I could respect that. It would at least show sense. Decton slung another stone that struck me in the neck, drawing blood. But your reason is more senseless than that. You won't harm me for the same reason you won't hurt one of these miserable, stinking beasts. With that, he kicked a goat furiously in the gut, bowling it over and sending it bawling. Because it will offend them. He gestured with bitter contempt across the plain to the gymnastic fields where three platoons of Spartiates were going through spear drill in the sun. You won't touch me because I'm their property. Just like these shit-eating goats. I'm right, aren't I? My expression answered for me. He glared at me with contempt. What are they to you, moron? Your city was sacked, they say. You hate the Argives and think these sons of Heracles, he indicated the drilling peers, spitting the final phrase with sarcastic loathing, are their enemies. Wake up! What do you think they would have done had they sacked your city, the same and worse, as they did to my country, to Messenia, and to me? Look at my face, look at your own. You've fled slavery only to become lower than a slave yourself. Decton was the first person I had ever met, man or boy, who had absolutely no fear of the gods. He didn't hate them, as some do, or mock their antics, as I had heard the impious freethinkers did in Athens and Corinth. Decton didn't grant their existence at all. There were no gods. It was as simple as that. This struck me with a kind of awe. I kept watch, waiting for him to be felled by some hideous blow of heaven. Now, on the road home from Antirion, Decton, I should say Rooster, continued the harangue I had heard from him so many times before. That the Spartans had gulled me like they gull everyone, that they exploit their chattel by permitting them the crumbs off their table, elevating one slave a fraction above another, and turning each individual's miserable hunger for station into the invisible bonds which held them in chains and in thrall. If you hate your masters so much, I asked him, why were you hopping like a flea during the battle, so frantic to get into the fight yourself? Another factor I knew added to Rooster's frustration. He had just got his barn friend, as the Helot boys called their illicit wenches, pregnant. Soon he would be a father. How could he flee then? He would not abandon a child, nor could he make his getaway lugging a girl and a babe. He stomped along, cursing one of the other herd boys who had let two goats stray, chasing the urchin back after these stragglers behind the herd. "Look at me," he growled as he fell again into step beside me. "I can run as fast as any of these Spartan dick-strokers. I'm 14, but I'll fight any 20-year-old man to man and bring him down. Yet here I try.